This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why are the words new, N-E-W, and so, S-E-W, pronounced so differently, even though they're just one letter apart? We'll talk to a linguist whose latest book looks at the oddities of the English language and where they came from. Now, President Biden was in Tokyo yesterday for the launch of a new economic framework in the Indo-Pacific region. Former President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, when he came into office 5 years ago. Since then, the U.S. has been in an uncertain position when it comes to leadership in the region. This new thing is called the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity. It's not a full-on negotiated trade deal like the TPP. So what is it? And what does it mean for the American economy? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of some kind of rebuilt economic bloc in the Pacific with the U.S. part of it? What questions you have about the United States could benefit or not from a new economic framework launched in Tokyo this week? Where does China fit into all of this? And do you personally want to sell more stuff in your line of work to that part of the world? Or does your business rely on buying stuff from the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kristen Vacasey is an associate professor of political science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. Her areas of expertise include international political economy, the geopolitics of supply chains, and Northeast Asia. And she earned her PhD in political science from UW-Madison. Kristen, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me. So happy to be here today.
All right, let's look first at this thing, this framework. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this long process, carefully negotiated tariffs and blah, blah, blah. What is this thing and how does it compare?
Absolutely. So during the Obama-Biden administration, there was a move to try and be a rulemaker in the Indo-Pacific region, or what we call now the Indo-Pacific region. And particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership was this effort to show economic leadership through building new standards, through increasing market access, through lowering non-tariff barriers, having shared investment standards, and even a few labor and environmental standards were thrown in there as well. It was painstakingly negotiated. And then during the 2016 election, it got very much thrown out under the bus by both the Democratic and Republican candidates. And on his first day in office, President Trump said he was throwing it out, much to the dismay of the other members of the agreement. Now, in response to that, Japan in particular took leadership in the TPP, and the remaining countries did sign something now known as the CPTPP. And there really still is a lot of appetite in Northeast Asia and across the whole Indo-Pacific region for these really detailed, comprehensive kinds of trade agreements in order to integrate supply chains, et cetera. So when Biden comes into office, he's faced with this challenge of how does the United States try and show economic leadership in this really prosperous part of the world that is eager for more interconnectivity and eager for real rulemaking without making the same domestic political mistakes that were made with the TPP. And right now, his answer is this Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which maybe we could say IPEF, but maybe we can just go with IPEF.
Yeah, it doesn't roll off the tongue exactly, IPEF. Now,
a
lot of this is defined by an absence here. The TPP did not include China. This IPEF, or whatever we're going to call it, doesn't include China. How big a part of the story is saying we'd rather have the United States be part of this kind of trade than let China dominate it?
That's a great question. So to some extent, there is eagerness to build a set of shared rules and standards in the region, whether it comes from the United States or China or Japan or whichever large economy is going to take that lead, there's eagerness. And you can see this, there's a whole constellation of trade agreements, of economic partnership agreements, of bilateral investment treaties, including the CPTPP, but also agreements like the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, which was signed last year and does include China, as well as most, not all, but most of the countries that are also involved, part of this new IPEF. And so to some extent, countries will join all of them. The countries, they're joiners, they'll join all of these agreements. But to some extent, the deliberate exclusion of the world's second largest economy from this agreement is showing that the United States would like to be a leader and take leadership in the region independent of China.
We're talking to Kristen Vacacy from the University of Maine, looking at this loose trade agreement signed between President Biden and a bunch of countries in Asia, Australia, the Indian Ocean region as well. It's not the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about all this at 800-642-1234. Are you glad the U.S. got out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Should we be trying to get back into it? What do you want to see? What do you want our economic relationship be with countries in that big region? And how about China along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen, there are some kind of main principles that are part of this framework for prosperity, as the administration is calling it. One of them, and you mentioned supply chains, and that's been obviously a huge issue this last couple of years. That's a big part of this, supply chain resilience. What are people talking about here?
Yeah, so we have seen supply chain disruptions, many of which were caused by the pandemic, but there's also other economic issues that have caused some of these supply chain issues that are contributing to inflation. Right now, the supply chain resiliency initiatives in this agreement are trying to have better information sharing, transparency in supply chains in order to guard against the kinds of price spikes and the kinds of supply disruptions that we've been seeing for the last few years. Now, you might think of things like semiconductors, and that might be part of this agreement. Taiwan is not part of the agreement, which is a large supplier of semiconductors. So maybe that's something we could talk about. But one of the things that's specifically mentioned are minerals and in the initial fact sheet from the White House. And we rely on China for a lot of critical minerals like rare earths. But there's also these minerals are also found within the region and the countries that are part of or have signed on initially to the IPEF. And they include things like rare earth minerals, but also things like nickel and other minerals that we need to make batteries, to make permanent magnets, to make all the sorts of fancy technologies that enable our modern life and will help us transition from fossil fuels.
We sometimes hear from the Biden administration and others the solution to the supply chain, the international supply chain problem, is to make more stuff here, to try to make the United States a manufacturer of microchips and some of the other things you just mentioned. Is that at odds with trying to get together with all these other countries and make sure that the stuff flows from there to here more easily?
I don't think it is at odds. It's with things like chips as well as with minerals in current demand, but even more predicted demand in the future is so high that we need all of them plus. And one of the benefits of an agreement like this, if it follows the path that we see in the initial language, is that you would have shared production standards, shared confidence that if a chip or a refined metal was made in one of the countries that's in the agreement, you would be getting the same quality and the same sort of process, hopefully the same environmental standards, the same labor standards in any of these countries, and it would facilitate imports and exports. And I think that also would help build more resilience for American manufacturing if it's done right.
Here in Wisconsin, we got a lot of manufacturing, a lot of agriculture. That was a lot of the focus here on Trump administration agreements with China, for example, the hope that we'd be able to sell more of that stuff to them. That never seemed to really come to fruition. Are these things we're talking about with these countries as part of this framework for prosperity?
To some extent, one of the critiques of the IPEF right now is that it's unclear what sorts of things the United States is going to offer to member countries or ask of member countries. You know, it's kind of clear what the Biden administration wants a end map to look like with, you know, supply chain resiliency, clean economy, some things with digital economy and whatnot, but it's unclear what that might mean for market access going either way. And that absence is something that we'll really need to pay attention to over the next few months as countries start to negotiate.
We're talking right now about a new economic framework President Biden and leaders of a dozen other countries rolled out yesterday for the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean region. That's a big region. Our guest is Kristen Vacacy, Associate Professor of Political Science at the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see get hammered out between the U.S. and all these trading partners in the Pacific region? What do you think about China's influence there? Are you glad the U.S. is trying to take an active leadership role in trade in the area? Would you want to go back to something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiated under the Obama administration, rejected early on in the Trump administration? Do you have worries about trade with a lot of these countries? Call 800-642-1234. With your questions, your comments, that's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about a new launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework this week. That's a deal between the U.S. and a bunch of countries, including India, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Indonesia, many more, establishing trade guidelines, cooperation guidelines on economic issues between these countries, but not a full-on trade agreement like the canceled Trans-Pacific Partnership. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions on the U.S. role in that region, what you'd hope for from trade agreements, loose or tight with those countries, your hopes for something that might affect your own business, maybe. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen Vacacy stays with us, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. Kristen, if this isn't like a full-fledged negotiated agreement like the TPP, does it really matter? Does it make a difference? Or is there something significant here?
That's a great question. So one of the reasons that this is not a trade agreement is it makes it more plausible that President Biden will be able to make some agreements in a shorter time frame with these partner countries. And so the goal right now is sort of the 12 to 18 months, there'll be some announcements of what's come out of the IPEF. And that can be done with executive action rather than votes by Congress. Now, the benefit of that is the shorter timeframe, but of course, that also means that partner countries might be skeptical that the commitments the United States makes and the agreements will last past a single administration. And so that's a risk in negotiation and might lead to they're more watered down agreements and maybe not as strong of rulemaking as you might see under a trade agreement. But it does allow the Biden administration and perhaps also the governments in Japan, South Korea, other member countries to be a little bit more to have a little bit more flexibility in their negotiations because it's a lower level than a trade agreement. So I'm hoping my optimistic view is that we're going to see some lively negotiations towards sort of the low-hanging fruit in negotiations, things maybe the easier things on digital governance, maybe some things on shared standards, et cetera.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in River Falls. Jim, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I guess, you know, when they negotiated the TPP, my concern about that was it was mostly negotiated behind closed doors with these major corporations having a lot of input into it. They didn't have human rights groups or environmental groups provide a lot of input into those agreements. And my understanding was that that would have benefited companies. It would have given them basically autonomy in areas where they had the corporations that they weren't subject to like our national laws or federal laws here or state or local ordinances either. So it was a win-win for the corporations, I think, but not necessarily for working people or, you know, people that are abused in foreign sweatshops.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And Jim really sums up very nicely, I think, Kristen, a lot of the objections to the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the first place.
Absolutely. That's a great comment and a great question. So indeed, so some of the big concerns that we saw were things like lack of transparency in the negotiating process. I think that the coverage of this question of supranational autonomy of MNCs with the TPP was a bit overblown. But there were also concerns that the TPP didn't take labor concerns seriously enough, and also that it didn't take environmental concerns seriously enough. And particularly, those are things that where the United States has typically higher environmental and labor standards than the partner countries. And so if we don't have shared standards and shared rules, that gives American industry and American manufacturing a big structural disadvantage. And so the language of the IPEF includes those concerns. It indicates that the Biden administration witnessed what happened with TPP and said, okay, on this next round, we are going to focus on those issue areas that had such large political problems in the TPP negotiations. Now, that does not guarantee a different outcome, but it does show attention to these problems. And in trade negotiations typically are private, and they do involve countries giving up sovereignty and then agreeing to rules that are shared across borders instead of being made at a national congressional level. And those certainly introduce the tension between national sovereignty and international agreements.
Thanks again. Absolutely. Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking with Kristen Vacacy from the University of Maine, looking at President Biden's trip and dealing with international trade partners in Asia and the Indian Ocean region, a loose framework kind of agreement, nothing as precise as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Kristen, another absence here. You mentioned Taiwan, a big economic power in its own right, not part of this deal. Taiwan in a weird position diplomatically. It's its own country, clearly, except China says it isn't. Diplomatically, people have to deal with it, pretend it doesn't exist. The U.S. policy has been strategic ambiguity, not saying whether or not we'd defend Taiwan if China attacks it. President Biden saying, yeah, we would. Can you talk about the Taiwan issue here?
Absolutely. So it's always difficult to talk about Taiwan because of there's a linguistic dance around the One China policy about recognition of Taiwan or non-recognition of Taiwan, but acknowledging China's policy that Taiwan is not a country. There's a lot of difficulties here. Most heads of state from around the world have messed this up, and the government in China typically responds in an aggravated way, as is what happened this time as well. Strategic ambiguity, the goals to try and deter China from a military takeover of Taiwan, perhaps something like what we see happening in Ukraine right now. So deterrence without aggravation, and so to maintain the status quo. Biden's statement was more straightforward. And this is not the first time he's made such a statement. It's the third time. I don't think that it really changes Beijing's understanding of what the United States would do, although there's, of course, a robust debate about that. But I think the United States has been pretty clear that we would defend Taiwan since the Taiwan Straits crisis in the mid-1990s when we brought the fleet in and indicated that indeed we would defend Taiwan. So I think it's strategic ambiguity, but there actually has been less ambiguity. But this question, this political question of Taiwan, we do see it playing out in the IPEF. Here's a place where we do see U.S.-China rivalry in the region affecting what happens in economic agreements. So countries like Malaysia, the Philippines, Thailand, it would aggravate their relationship with China if they joined an agreement where Taiwan was also a member. And so although there was interest in bringing Taiwan into the IPEF, they were not invited for these political reasons.
Now, briefly, if we're trying to work, as part of this is the supply chain stuff like we were talking about earlier. if we don't have Taiwan in here, which provides so many of the chips that, you know, a bunch of cars and parking lots in the Detroit area are waiting for. We don't include China, which if it shuts down Shanghai, say, because of COVID, we feel it here in the United States. How much supply chain can we fix without those two?
Sure. So there are we're doing things to fix the supply chain without this agreement. And hopefully Taiwan will be brought into some of these regional agreements at some point. They have, for example, applied for membership in the TPP, and that probably would help alleviate some of the chip issues. But I think that broader regional cooperation in standard setting would help alleviate supply chain issues, but that the political reality on the ground is that the United States needs to start here, and then maybe over time can start to incorporate some of those other countries.
And just our last half a minute, Kristen, what are you watching for next on this framework?
I'm watching to see the countries can choose which pillar of the four pillars they want to join. I'm waiting to see which countries will choose which pillars and whether we'll do bilateral or multilateral negotiations.
Kristen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's Kristen Vacacy, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. We talked with her today about a new economic framework, they're calling it. President Biden and leaders from a dozen Pacific countries laid out this week for the region what it could all mean for the U.S. and for some of the supply chain issues still plaguing the U.S. economy and the rest of the world, for that matter. You can keep sharing your thoughts on this or any issue. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR or make comments over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and share these conversations over at WPR.org or use the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a Wisconsin author shares stories of historical American figures in children's book form. Join the conversation about kids' books starring real people and what children can learn from them. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Once upon a time, payphones were all over the place. If you don't remember that time, it was pretty straightforward. You put some coins in the phone, you make your call, you hope somebody answers. Or if you were in a suspense movie, a payphone would ring as you walked by, and answering it would draw you into a dangerous web of international intrigue. It's no secret that those days are over, but here's a new milestone. As reported by NPR, the last public payphone has been removed in New York City. There's still a few private ones up, lovingly protected by nostalgic fans, but unless you go looking for those, you're not going to run into a payphone in the whole Big Apple. How about you, community? Do you still have a payphone near you? When was the last time you used one? Let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. And hey, take a picture of that payphone with your cell phone. Hey, maybe that's why they went away. Please deposit 25 cents to continue this call. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, the English language has a lot of strange spellings, pronunciations, and rules. There are silent letters, unexpected pronunciations, and expressions that don't make a lot of sense when you really think about them. Our guest today wanted to know why noses run and feet smell, why of isn't spelled with a V, and why the British put a U in the word color, and we don't. So she wrote a book about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What weird English language rules stand out to you? What words do you think are spelled strangely or pronounced funny if English isn't your first language? What parts were the hardest for you to learn? What made the least sense to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erica Okrin is a linguist and author of the book Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. Erica, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into some of the big picture stuff, let's start with one example that illustrates a lot of it right out of the title of your book. Tough through dough, throw in a hiccup and some others there. O-U-G-H. Why don't all words with that letter cluster rhyme?
Yeah, they look the same. It seems like they should sound the same, but we have just a mess of different pronunciations. Sometimes it's an F, like a cough, or sometimes it's not pronounced at all. The vowels are all different. And the reason, as with most weird things about English, is history and the unusual history of the language. That GH there in those words we used to pronounce. It's an old sound that English doesn't have anymore. That's sort of like a blech sound. And if you look at some words in German and their English counterparts, you can see like night, Nacht, light, Licht, neighbor, Nachbar. That's still in German. And they go back, both German and English, go way back to the same distant ancestor. So we had that sound, and we had it long enough to get it into the writing, but we didn't keep it. And now it shifted and changed in various ways, giving us all kinds of different pronunciations, but not before it got settled in the writing.
And it got settled in different ways, because as you mentioned, sometimes that sound turned into an F, sometimes it disappeared altogether. So maybe that town over there won on dough, and that town over there won on tough.
Yeah, and sometimes there's still two. So we have dough, but there's in England, there's a dessert called plum duff that they eat at Christmas time. And that's the same word. They say duff. And it went on to that usage. But in other places, it became dough. So yeah, just to make it more confusing.
And this example illustrates the main theme of your book, that we can look at English in 2022 and say, yeah, it's just English. It's weird and there aren't any rules. But all of this stuff comes out of a long history, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not random. It feels like it's very random and unexplainable. It's not random and it's not unexplainable, but that doesn't mean it's logical. So things change in one place, but not in another. Things change at one point in history, and that leaves lumps and bumps that don't get changed later. So we can explain it, but sometimes it's a pretty involved explanation. But it is there, and we don't have to feel like it's just crazy. It doesn't make any sense. Well, it doesn't make any sense, but there's a reason for it.
Now, we asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page for some of their examples, and the first one we got is the first one you tackle in the book. Ted just had a one-word answer to our question, colonel, like the rank in the army, C-O-L-O-N-E-L. There's not an R in sight, and we say colonel, and that's got a trilingual story you write in the book.
Yeah, how do you spell this word? How do you say this word? They don't match at all, but they did at one time. When we first got the word colonel, we borrowed it from French, who at that time said coronel, so we took coronel, and we dropped some syllables from coronel to colonel. That's a very typical thing that happens in language change. But then in the 15th, 1600s, people went back to the source of these words, which was Italian, and started reading these old Italian military treatises. And they said, colonel, that's what it was in Italian. French had changed the L to the R in coronel. So we looked at those old texts and said, oh, well, it's properly, it should be colonel. And if you were educated and wanted to show that you were educated, you started writing it colonel. And French actually changed, they say colonel now, but we kept saying colonel, but while writing it colonel. And some people tried to change the pronunciation, but it's much harder to change how people speak than it is to change how they write, because it's a certain class of people are doing the writing and they get to make the decisions for the writing, but they can't necessarily say, okay, everyone, now we're going to pronounce it this way. And so We're lucky we get both. We get the whole range.
We're talking to Erica Okrent, a linguist, author of the new book, Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. You can join in with your own examples. What are the things that stand out to you as weird in the way we spell or say words in English? Do you have a question for our guest about why these things happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, we got into that early Germanic stuff. We've borrowed one from the French. Those are two big sections of your book. You just mentioned written English, and a thing that locked in a lot of weirdnesses is the invention of the printing press. What happened?
Yeah, the printing press made it easier to produce written texts in English. Written texts were being produced before then, but at the time it was, 1476, that's when it came to England. And English was in kind of a transition at that point because it had stopped being a written language for a few hundred years after the French takeover. People were still speaking English, but the writing was in French and or in Latin. It was controlled by the class of people who do the writing, and they were not speaking English. They were doing French or Latin. So English is starting to become a written language again, it's very different now. How do we spell things? How do we write things? The language is not the same as it was when we had a writing system of old English. So it's up in flux. It's changing. Meanwhile, the printing press is doing great. People love having the ability to print out things and spread them around, but nobody's doing it consistently. There's no such thing as a dictionary. There's no such thing as an editor or a book of here's our house style. Everyone's winging it, doing different things based on their pronunciation, based on what they've seen before. And it's all spreading around really fast now because we can produce the texts so much faster. So that period of time, it was really unlucky that the time when the printing press came, the language wasn't in a position to be settled. It was very much in flux. And so it settled in this way, in that way, in that way, in this place, in that place, in all kinds of different ways. And now we're stuck with the results because you can't change it now.
So we're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Madison. Laura, hi. Are you there, Laura?
Hi, I'm here. I was wondering what the difference was between awesome and awful. Why, if there's some awe, why wouldn't it be full of awe? And awful means something completely different. Thank you.
Interesting, Laura. Thanks, Erica.
Yeah, that's a very typical thing we do in English and other languages too. We have sort of opposite meaning words from the same root. So we awful is bad and awesome is good. We have, terrible is bad and terrific is good, but those both come from terror. And it's kind of similar to awe because awe was fear. That's something you tremble with awe before a great power. And that to be awful was to be sort of having this feeling of fear, trembling before power. So how do we get from that to awesome? Well, fear, we like to use fear to intensify what we're trying to say. So when words get a little stale or a little boring, we don't want to say, oh, that was a really good performance. We want to say, oh, that was frightfully good, which was, that was popular a few decades ago. But another way to do that is to say it was awesome. Like it was so good. It was scary good. That's something we do now. We use fear to intensify the positive emotion we want to express. And we have a few vocabulary items that have made that flip back and forth. Fear is a really great way to freshen up your vocabulary when it's starting to get boring and stale.
We're having an awfully good conversation with linguist Erica Okrent about her latest book, Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. You can share your favorites or confusions at 800-642-1234. What English pronunciations and or spelling strike you as odd? Do you wonder why certain words look the way they do? What are your favorite or least favorite quirks of this English language? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with linguist Erica Okrent. Her latest book is called Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the origins of certain strangenesses in the English language, the way we spell and pronounce and say stuff. Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Anne is with us in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. So I teach preschool and kindergarten, and we don't really worry about spelling at this age. It's not the most important thing at all. But the children who are ready for spelling are so confused. They're like, they see this O-U-G-H, and they see enough and through, and they're just like, what? Why?
What do you tell them, Anne, when they ask you why?
I basically say what the author said at the very beginning. I say, English is weird. You know, and sometimes I give little hints towards, we our language comes from several other languages. But, you know, it's a pretty complex topic for a five-year-old.
Yeah.
And so I was really wondering, though, I had read this study that said that there are languages that are orthographically simple, whereas ours has orthographic complexity, which basically means weird spellings, mm-hmm. as far as I understand it. And that our language and languages with this complexity take like 3 years longer for children to learn to write.
Interesting. And thanks for the call. And I know, Erica, I try and fail to learn Spanish. And the letter, one thing I like is the letters. You see that letter? It's always going to be said the same pretty much. Is English orthographically complex, like Anne said? Does it make it harder to learn to spell?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's not as hard to learn to spell or to write as Mandarin or something. That takes a lot longer. But of all the languages that use the Latin alphabet, English is the most confusing because the Latin alphabet and its adoption happened at more convenient times in other languages, either after they had already gone through major changes or before. So it might be inconsistent, like French has a lot of rules you have to learn, but you can fit them all on a few pages and they're pretty consistent. Polish looks very complex to us, but it's very simple. You can put all the rules on a page and know how to pronounce it. And most languages that use the Latin alphabet are like that. But no, English to list all of its exceptions and rules takes about 450 pages. That's the most complete explanation of English spelling is ridiculous that way. So learning to read and write English is a lot more difficult than it is in other languages because of that the bad timing of the printing press, which is when things get settled. How do we spell this? What's our habit? That happened over the course of a couple hundred years, but at a very bad time when the language was really changing. The whole vowel system was changing. English had not been written that much before, so it was a bad stroke of bad luck for English writing.
Thanks for the call. Anne, we'll go to Marie now in Eau Claire. Marie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Marie?
Hey, I just was going to coattail on that comment. I'm just wondering, I know the printing press was invented a long time ago, but I'm wondering why there can't be a few spelling changes a year. You know, we have a few new words a year. There's a couple of words that would be so helpful if we could change them. I'm a reading tutor, especially silent letters. Couldn't we all agree on 5 or 10 a year that we drop the G in knife or we drop the G in gnome, that would just make it easier for everyone. Is there a reason we can't have a consensus to make these type of progressive changes?
Marie, thanks for that call. Actually, it's even worse than that, Erica. If I remember correctly, when we were trying to standardize English, we actually added in some silent letters because people thought it'd be more consistent, like O-U-G-H has got added where they hadn't been before.
Yeah. Sometimes like the word haughty is didn't originally have that G-H in there, but it seemed to look better. And we do and have made decisions based on the look of words. So like the word could did not have an L in it. But should and would did, because those come from shall and will. So there's a reason for the L in should and would. Could comes from can. There was no reason for there to be an L, but it fits together with those two other words. They're similar in function. They're similar in form. It just evened out the little paradigm there to put the L in. So yeah, that's sort of the opposite of what you're saying. Putting in words, putting in letters where they never were and shouldn't be is something we've also done. But people have tried. They have tried over and over again to simplify English spelling. Many proposals have been put out. Many people have, they've created a whole journal written in simple English or whatever their system is. And the problem is that it just looks too funny. It's sort of like when you see one of those meme, like I Ken has cheeseburger type writing. If you see a lot of text in simplified English, it looks funny to us. And it's even harder to read for people who have already become literate. Now, if you're just learning to read, it would make sense. But it's kind of too late. We have too much of a habit already established so that if we try to simplify too much, it actually becomes harder to recognize the word fast enough because we don't sound things out so much when we're reading, unless it's an unfamiliar word. We recognize. So it's the balance between the people who already know it and the people who are trying to learn it. And it's really hard to make the change for the benefit of the people who are trying to learn it when there are so many people who just have the habit already.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Erica Okrent. Her new book is called Highly Irregular. It's about the weirdnesses of the English language, how they got there. Back to your calls. Fawn is with us in Madison. Hi, Fawn.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on that same topic. My godfather, my late godfather, John Malone, he invented an alternate orthography for English where there was one letter for each phoneme, for each sound that's in the English language, and one letter per sound. He called it unifon, U-N-I-F-O-N. So there wouldn't be those irregularities of Q-U. That would be K-W or, the rest that you're describing. And it's like, it's as you said, those things never catch on. Like hooked on phonics, that can't be turned into our regular everyday spelling because people are too attached to the old traditions, I guess you could say. But it's a shame, really, because given that English is de facto the world's universal language, lingua franca, as it were, universal language, people from all over the globe shouldn't have to learn this convoluted and tortured spelling just to communicate with each other. And so what you're describing is that you're saying that English is, in essence, part phonetic but part ideograms in the wake of a word, and you recognize the meaning even before you recognize the.
Gotcha. Fawn, we don't have too much time left. Looks like 40 letters in that Unifon system. Erica, the tricky thing here is trying to change language in any way by doing it on purpose.
Yeah, this is, language is, it's a part of nature. It's a human behavior, and it's not amenable to control from above. So, invent a new language that has no irregularities and perfect match between meaning and form. You can spend your lifetime inventing that, but that has nothing to do with if you make it perfect, but how will you get people to use it? That's the part that doesn't follow. It's very hard to make people change their language from above with some kind of system, no matter how perfect the system is. But it's also perfect is in the eye of the beholder. And everybody who's created these has come up with a different way of doing it. And also, if you're doing it for spelling, it's based on your pronunciation, which differs from other people's. You know, people have accents, people pronounce vowels differently, people do or do not pronounce certain letters in different places. And so who's gets to be the official version? That's always going to come up when you're trying to create a perfect spelling.
Erica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. That's Erica Okrent, linguist and author of the book Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme and Other Oddities of the English Language. You can keep sharing your strangenesses and oddities of the English language, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or share your favorites, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, cutting down air pollution could save a lot of lives. That's according to some new UW research. We'll talk to one of the researchers about those findings. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear the story of a Wisconsin man who got a wrongful conviction overturned and went on to become a lawyer working to help other wrongfully convicted people in the criminal justice system. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.